Hare Krishna. Okay, so reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 9, Mother Yashoda binds Lord Krishna. And reading text 16 and 17. So I'll just read 16 and then we can do 17 together. Actually, I'll start with, read 15 again, just because it's all part of it. So 15 was, when Mother Yashoda was trying to bind the offending child, she saw that the binding rope was short by a distance, the width of two fingers. Thus, she brought another rope to join to it. 16. This new rope also was short by a measurement of two fingers, and when another rope was joined to it, it was still two fingers too short. As many ropes as she joined, all of them failed. Their shortness could not be overcome. Okay, and then 17, translation, by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thus, Mother Yashoda joined whatever ropes were available in the household, but still she failed in her attempt to bind Krishna. Mother Yashoda's friends, the elderly gopis in the neighborhood, were smiling and enjoying the fun. Similarly, Mother Yashoda, although laboring in that way, was also smiling. All of them were struck with wonder. The purport. Actually, this incident was wonderful because Krishna was only a child with small hands. To bind him should have required only a rope, not more than 2 feet long. All the ropes in the house combined together might have been hundreds of feet long, but still he was impossible to bind, for all the ropes together were still too short. Naturally, Mother Yashoda and her gopi friends thought, how is this possible? Seeing this funny affair, all of them were smiling. The first rope was short by a measurement the width of two fingers, and after the second rope was added, it was still two fingers too short. If the shortness of all the ropes were added together, it must have amounted to the width of hundreds of fingers. Certainly this was astonishing. This was another exhibition of Krishna's inconceivable potency to his mother and his mother's friends. Om Agyanta Marandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Malitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Titanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vancha Kampa Kalpa Purushtas Cha Kirpasandubhya Vacha Patidnam Pavanim Yovaishna Vimbhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Taitanya Prabhanitananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shiva Sarigora Bhaktarinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So here, Nandan Prabhu asked me once again to try and speak something on the 10th canto, which is really not that easy to do, especially for someone like me. But anyway, I'll give it a go. And this is a very famous pastime as well. So seeking the blessings of the devotees that might be able to say something sensible. So near the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, we find this verse spoken. It says, Krishna sva dhamma pagate dharma jnana dibi saha kalo nashta drishamesha puranarko dhanoditaha. So he said, this Bhagavat Purana is as brilliant as the sun, and it is manifested just after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode, accompanied by knowledge and religion. Persons who have lost their vision in the dense darkness of the ignorance of Kali Yuga will get light from this Purana. So this is the Srimad Bhagavatam, this is Bhagavat Purana. So after the departure of Lord Krishna from this world, of course it was a very distressing time, and it was the beginning, the advent of Kali Yuga, of which we're all experiencing very much now. But then where did all the religiosity go? Where did all the insight go? Where did Krishna go? So it said he's here in Srimad Bhagavatam is where Krishna is. So we must continue to have faith in that, and to read from Bhagavatam in that light, that Krishna is present in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So all the previous nine cantos, they bring us up to this point. I said that after reaching the end of the nine cantos, we've already reached liberation, because we've been told everything that is necessary to be known. And Srila Prabhupada, the Acharya of this age, has given these wonderful purports by which we can even understand in our conditioned state what this is. And now, in the 10th canto, Krishna himself manifests, and this brings pure bhakti, arises within the heart, so we can understand in this way. So Krishna is always present in his eternal abode, and he's present there with all his associates, all his paraphernalia, and that abode is made of his internal energy, so completely spiritual energy. Whereas this material world, this is made of the external energy of Krishna, a completely different environment. But when Krishna descends into this material world, he's surrounded by his internal potency, which is called Atmamaya. So this Atmamaya is completely spiritual, not at all material. So we should understand that Krishna's pastimes here on this very earth planet over 5,000 years ago were completely spiritual in nature. So why does he come? Well, he comes to reclaim all the fallen conditioned souls, and to reestablish the principles of religion that have been lost. That's why he descends. And so real religion, what is it? Well, real religion means to know God, to know about our relationship with God, and to know our duties in relation with God, and also to know our ultimate destination after this lifetime. But for the conditioned souls who are not accepting Krishna, then it's a very different affair. So the conditioned soul, the conditioned jiva, is very much entrapped by the material energy, and he hardly knows anything about these principles of life, the principles according to God. So for the conditioned souls, they can't see beyond the mind, the intelligence, and the ego. They can't see any further than that. So in that way, they are completely blind. So we've got great fortune that we're approaching Krishna in this way. So now we hear about, in this 10th canto, about Krishna's actual pastimes in this earthly realm all those years ago. And we've this pastime here about when Mother Yashoda is binding Lord Krishna. So Krishna is obviously very, very young still at this point. And but Mother Yashoda has decided that he's old enough to receive some discipline, because he's been very naughty. He's been very much misbehaving according to her vision. So this pastime begins to take place. And I always used to wonder, because this pastime, it can seem like, well, it's just something that happened a long time ago. This Mother Yashoda binds Lord Krishna. It happens at a certain time, and then that's it. But then, you know, realizing more now, and also after reading His Holiness Shivaram Swami's book, Sri Damodar Janani, you realize that actually, according to the vision of the Acharyas, give much more information. Actually, it's like quite a big episode. So I was seeing a very, very tiny vision of what that might be. But that's the beauty of the Srimad Bhagavatam and the vision of the previous Acharyas. So Mother Yashoda's, she's trying now to bind Lord Krishna. He's misbehaving, and she's, I'm just going to tie him up to something. So she finds this like upturned mortar that's just lying around, so I'll tie him to that, she thinks. And of course, there's many other observers on that scene. I hadn't realized this. Many other observers, because when you think about it, it would be, because it's God himself, Krishna, a beautiful personality is actually there. So it's described that firstly, there are all the demigods in the heavenly regions. They're all coming down to watch. You know, they're amazed what's happening. then you have all the birds and the monkeys and the animals and the trees. They're all watching as well. They're fascinated. Then you have the elderly gopis who are with Mother Yashoda and their families. And as the pastime progresses, even more come to watch because this enchanting pastime. But many of them are thinking, all these different observers of this event, they are all having different opinions about the possible success or failure of that mission that Mother Yashoda. Is it possible that she's going to be able to bind Krishna? So one observer is thinking, well, this Krishna, he's got no beginning and no end. He's inconceivable. It seems that he can do whatever he wants. What rope could possibly encircle this infinite, entity? Is it at all possible? Another one is thinking, well, he's the cause of all causes. So that means that the universe and everything in the universe, including the ropes, they're part of him. So how could he be bound by these ropes, which are also part of him? Obviously, he doesn't want to be bound by ropes. Then another is thinking, but he's the controller of time itself. So at this point, he's not bound by ropes. So why should it be that in some future time he will be bound by ropes if he's the controller of time itself? These are interesting insights, because I was also thinking, well, it talks about Krishna's yoga maya, so everybody's just really in one sense bewildered by what's happening. But on the other hand, it could seem that these are like eternal associates of Krishna, so they're not completely covered. They have some extra insight about what's going on. That's an interesting thing. But Mother Yashoda, she's started to try to tie this rope around Krishna. And then she's realizing that actually all these ropes, they're not long enough. They're not long enough. But the strange thing is, because his waist is so thin, just like the size of her fist, how can it be? So the first amazing thing she's thinking is, well, his waist is so small, and his waist is not getting any smaller, and the ropes, his waist is not getting any bigger, but all these ropes that were tying together, they're not getting any smaller, but still, we can't circle it around him. So that's the first amazing thing. And then the second amazing thing is that when she's tying all the ropes together, they just don't quite meet, but it's always like two fingers short. Never three or four, but always two fingers short. So that's the second amazing thing. That comes from the vision of Srila Vishvanath Chakravarti Thakur. Very interesting insights. So anyway, it's all going on, and now all the elderly gopis, they're standing watching all of this, and they're just smiling to this. It's just so wonderful to watch. You know, the object of their love is there, Krishna's there, and Mother Yashoda's trying to tie him up with ropes, and she's going through her whole thing. Sometimes she's getting a little bit maybe frustrated, and then sometimes she's just smiling as well, because it's just so wonderful, as it says. It's just astonishing, as it says in the purport, completely astonishing. So this is all going on. But then what I was thinking, what came into my mind was also like, so, you know, Mother Yashoda, she's there as one of Krishna's eternal associates, Krishna's eternal mother. And the elderly gopis, they're all Krishna's eternal associates with Krishna in the spiritual world. But as we've mentioned, there's also this material world, lest we forget we're still in it. But what's the experience of the conditioned soul is somewhat different, because actually the conditioned soul is also trying to bind the material energy, trying to control the material energy, you know, trying to enjoy and control it. But for the material soul, conditioned soul, they're finding that actually they can't do that. the same way that Mother Yashoda is finding she can't bind Krishna, so the conditioned jiva is finding that they can't enjoy the material atmosphere all around. So just, you know, this is part of our philosophy as well, like to understand, you know, what the difference between this material world and the spiritual world. So this, like, material world, you know, the nature, if you look at it closely, it might seem, you can look at it and think, well, it's a beautiful scenery and it looks very nice. If you look down from an airplane, it looks great, you know, fantastic. You know, all the opportunity, I can have such a great time here and everything. But then when you look at it really closely, you find it's not that at all. Because nature itself, it's like a battlefield. All the creatures, they're just locked in combat with each other. From the tiny little bacteria to the insects to the four-legged creatures to the birds, it's just a huge battlefield. It's like a big fight for survival. And we're in the midst of all of that. So I remember seeing that some years ago when I was working with sheep in the lambing season, when all the little lambs came. Potentially that's a wonderful scene, the lovely little fluffy lambs jumping around. But then you realize the power of nature. It's like from above, there's a threat from above. The crows, they want to come down and kill the lambs. The hawks, they want to come down and kill the lambs and eat them. From all sides, there are like foxes and weasels and all sorts of creatures. They're just waiting to run out and catch the lambs and eat them. And then from within, you get flies who crawl inside the lambs and lay their eggs inside the lamb, and then they all hatch out from within the lamb. You know, it's all pretty disturbing. Nature is quite disturbing. There's death all around. And what is it like for us, our experience? You know, we have this body, we have this mind, but we know that we sense, you know, that we're not, this body is not what we are, this mind is not what we're something else, something separate from that. But also realize that we're limited by that. I'm limited by my body, what I can do, and I'm limited by my mind, what I can do. You know, but also simultaneously, the biggest possibilities I've got of doing anything are my body and mind. What can I do without my body and mind? So it's this kind of dilemma. The source of all my suffering is in my body and is in my mind. So therefore, every step that I take in life, or we take, it's only ever like a kind of half step, because there's always that anxiety about what will happen. What will happen to me when I take this next step? And that can lead to great anxiety. Some people have huge anxiety about even stepping outside the front door, you know, because you just don't know what's going to happen. So people are not actually taking steps in search of like love or happiness, really. They're just taking steps to ensure their security at the next moment, if you think about it. But that constant pursuit of security is actually pursuit of death itself, because there is no security in the material world, and death is just around the corner at any time. So while we're in this condition, this limited condition, it means that there'll always be fear of suffering. There'll always be it'll always be security oriented. All my activities will always have that in mind, that my security. So we can't. That's the first thing. We can't really be completely happy in this material nature at any point, really. Of course, there are moments when we, in the mind, can decide that it's so wonderful, so great, but that doesn't last very long. It's a temporary relief from that. So that's the first thing, that we can't really engage in this without suffering. And then the second thing comes from the attraction between male and female. So Rishabhadev, he's Krishna himself, and when he's speaking to his 100 sons, he says many, many wise things. This is in the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. He says, Pumsa striya matuni bhavamitam, tayar mito hirdiya grantu ahu, ato griha shetra sutapta viter, janasya mohayam aham mameti. So he said the attraction between male and female is a basic principle of material existence. On the on the basis of this misconception, which ties together the hearts of the male and female, one becomes attracted to his body, home, property, children, relatives, and wealth. In this way, one increases life's illusions, and he thinks in terms of I and mine. So, very interesting, this misconception, because actually, the other person is not the attractive factor. Actually, it's Krishna is the attractive factor. But we just think, we put that attraction, we take it, we don't want to surrender to Krishna, so we put it on to someone else. We see like a beautiful girl, a beautiful boy, and we say, ah, there's my attractive attention. That's my attention is going there. But that's a complete misconception. But don't worry, because for devotees, for anyone who is accepting Krishna, it's another circumstance altogether. So if we follow the principles, the proper principles given by God, then we can have that facility. We can have marriage and we can have union and bring children into the world. But for the conditioned souls, it's a slightly different situation. So often the best example of how material energy cannot satisfy, how we cannot completely bind material nature to satisfy ourselves, comes also from this realization of this attraction between male and female, how it just so often just goes completely wrong. I mean, I could start to talk about my own experiences, but I'll spare you that. But, you know, millions and billions of stories about this will abound, and but we always have, you know, there's always the two finger, like fingers crossed. So anyone who wants to approach that, wish them good fortune. But also for devotees, it's a different matter because Krishna is the center. So that makes everything different. Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokulananda Bhagavan Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Shri Shri Gornitai Shimata Vrindadeva Shila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Actually, it's... one thing is that actually since time immemorial in that Vedic culture in India, because there was no conception of divorce. Divorce is a Western conception. We're just listening to one class there. One interview is interviewing Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada is describing his life. He's now 74 years old. He was married. He was married, he has children, and the interview is saying, so where are they now? And he said, well, I've left them. You know, I've left my wife, I've left my children. And the interview says, why? Well, it's because I've taken the order of sannyas. I've given up this world of marriage. Because I'm dedicating my whole life to the spiritual upliftment of human civilization. And then the interviewer says, so did you divorce your wife then? And Srila Prabhupada says, no, there's no concept of divorce in Vedic culture. One never divorces like that. So, but actually, because of that, in India there was always many, many men would leave their wife, leave their family behind, and just take up spiritual life. Maybe he should give the class. He'd probably do a better job. He's got a lot to say. But in India, you always had that. So men, they couldn't, to be able to leave the family, leave the wife, they had to take up this mendicant path. So you have that particular aspect of Indian culture, the wandering sadhu. He's not always such greatly spiritually enlightened. It's often just to probably get away from the wife and get away from the family. But anyway, that's one part of culture which is very intriguing. But Shastra gives many examples of love and sex-driven relationships. And they're all very instructive to us because the ones that work are the ones where the principles given by God are very strictly followed. And there are many examples, but one is certainly in Kardanamuni and Devahuti. So it's a very interesting pastime also because Kardanamuni, he was a very advanced sage, a very advanced mystic, and he just spent 10,000 years of his life just in deep meditation, to the point where he was able, Krishna himself appeared to Kardama Muni after all these 10,000 years, because back at that time, it was a different age. People had a long lifespan, much longer than now. So he had actually 10,000 years in meditation. So perfect was his meditation that Krishna himself appeared to him. And then Krishna offered a benediction. What? I must give you something. You know, you've held me in your heart. You've practiced so well. And Kardama Muni said, yeah, I'd like to actually find a wife. I'd like to be married. You know, find a girl who's like of the same disposition as me. I like to enjoy that. So Krishna allowed this to be. But not just any girl, of course. It was Devahuti, who was daughter of Swayambhuva Manu. So this is right in the beginning of this creation. So trillions of years ago, really, we're talking about on this planet. And Devahuti, this daughter from this extremely royal family. So they came together in marriage, and so perfectly was she as a wife that she surrendered all that opulence to live in the hermitage with Kardama Muni. So then she became extremely austere, and she was serving Kardama Muni so well, so perfectly, giving up everything, all the pleasures, absolutely. And in course of that, her hair became very long and ragged, all her clothes became rags. She was really... But at some point, she reminded Kardama Muni, actually, the promise that was made, I should have said there was a promise that was made, was that he would give her children. So now had the time had come for that. And so she said, but we can't do it like this. We can't bring children in this environment. So Kardama Muni, so great was his mystic abilities that he manifested this like aerial vimana, this aerial palace, like a spaceship, aerial spaceship, full of all opulences, full of many, many gardens and palaces and parks, and very enchanting. And then Devahuti herself was attended by many goddesses of fortune and from within the river Jamuna, and she was made very beautiful once again. And so they spent many, many years traveling throughout the universe, and eventually some children came. So that's just an example of a very high example, where marriage can be very successful. So this is far beyond the material realm. Of course, this is approaching the spiritual realm. There's other examples like Gandhari, the wife of Dhritarashtra. Because Dhritarashtra, he was blind from birth, both physically and spiritually, it seems. But Gandhari, his wife, agreed to wear a blindfold for her life while she was married to Dhritarashtra. So this is the position, the true position of, and a great example of a wife. But of course, in the material realm, we're seeing that things don't happen quite like this at all. So anyway, without getting too distracted, the main point was we can't enjoy the material world in that way. It can't be bound just because we want to and enjoy and control it. It's not going to happen that way. Actually, Srila Prabhupada, he said about the material situation that it's very, very difficult because for the conditioned soul, he doesn't know what's happened before. He doesn't know what's happened before. Doesn't know what's going to come in the future, and doesn't know that life is continuous, that it keeps on going, like body after body. They're thinking that I have this life now for whatever reason, but at some point it'll all be finished. Death will come and it'll all be over. But this is called ignorance. This is tamas. And so this is having no knowledge at all. This is the mode of ignorance. Those who are simply interested in enjoying in the present with no understanding of the past, no understanding of the future. But yet this is the position of most people in Kali Yuga. So we all have there's a responsibility to educate humanity on this Srimad Bhagavatam and try to get past people's blocks about approaching Krishna and to realize that this philosophy is so mighty and works on so many levels. Because again, Rishabhadev, he's saying, he says, you know, when a person considers sense gratification to be the actual aim of life, he's certainly bewildered and just becomes a victim of the material energy. It's Nunam Pramata Kurite Vikarma Ya Indriya Pratya Pranoti Sadumanya Yata Atmano Yam Asana Piklejida Asadeha. Yeah, when a person considers sense gratification to be the aim of life, he certainly becomes bewildered. This word, pramata, is it like madman? So Srila Prabhupada is saying that modern civilization is like a madman civilization. For that reason, that there's no knowledge of past life, no knowledge of future life, ultimately no sense of responsibility. Because without knowing where we've come from, without knowing where we're going, one just gets the feeling, okay, I just want to enjoy everything I can now. So there's no responsibility. And also, if there's no knowledge, if one doesn't inquire about that spiritual life, then certainly he remains bewildered and suffering, in a suffering condition. So the whole point of Vedic literature is to uplift the conditioned soul from knowledge, from ignorance to knowledge. Yeah. So how is that going to happen? Well, it can only happen when we understand that Krishna is the source of everything, that Krishna is working from within. You see in Bhagavad Gita, Tesham Ivanukampartam, Ahamagyana Jam Mataha, Nashyame Atma Bhavasto Gyana Dipati Basvata. So, to show them my special mercy, I from within are destroying with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So, actually, Krishna is within us as Paramatma within the heart. So, when he sees that we're ready, then he will manifest in our life. First of all, he'll take away the suffering that comes from being in the material realm. And then gradually, according to our surrender, he will reciprocate and we will get increasing spiritual knowledge about how to return to Krishna's realm. So this is available for everyone. It doesn't matter which race we've been born into. It doesn't matter what our previous circumstance has been, because Krishna's there as Paramatma. In Bhagavad Gita it talks about Kshetra and Kshetra Gna. So Kshetra is like the field or the body or experience. Kshetra Gna is the knower of the body. So there are two knowers of the body. One is the individual soul itself, which doesn't really usually know very much about itself. It can only know itself. How many of us really know ourselves? But the other is the Paramatma. So Paramatma knows that individual soul where he's residing, but he also knows every other individual soul. So he knows everyone because he's Krishna himself in this Paramatma form. So Krishna also says, Tesha maham samudartat mrityu samsara sagarat bhavami nachirat parta maya veshita chetasa. So Krishna's saying, anyone who meditates upon me, who has his mind fixed on me, then I am the swift deliverer from the ocean of suffering. It says, this na chirat means not a long time, swiftly, on the spot. Srila Prabhupada says many times, he said, devotees ask him, how long does it take, you know, to get to Krishna? And he says, like, 1 minute, you know, 1 second, just a tiny moment of time is all it can take for Krishna to manifest. One just has to surrender enough for it to happen that way. So we can see that, like, man, it's like if you put, a man is like fallen in the ocean, so he may struggle very hard, and even if he's a very good swimmer, he might not be saved. So in that way, you know, there are many, many paths to spiritual paths. Many, many take many, many years to perfect. Like many of the yogic paths, it take years and years and years to reach that perfection, to reach that point of meditation upon Paramatma within the heart. But on the path of bhakti, the Lord Himself personally delivers that devotee. It doesn't take many, many years of practice. All it takes is love to start to cultivate that love for Krishna. That's all it takes. So even though that man struggling in the ocean may be a perfect swimmer, still he won't be saved. But if someone comes to pick up that person from the ocean, then he's rescued. And that's the analogy, that Krishna will come and pick them up. We see pastime of Rukmini, beautiful pastime, where Rukmini, she's supposed to be married to Shishupal, and to her this is like an abominable thought. That's the last person she wants to be married to. So she writes a secret letter to Krishna, and Krishna receives that letter. And then at the right moment, Krishna sweeps in on his chariot and lifts up Rukmini and takes her away from the assembly of all these kings and princes who want to personally marry Rukmini. So this is like an example of Krishna will just appear and just uplift that devotee. But first that devotee has to be surrendered, so that in that way the Lord picks up the devotee from material existence. Even we can see that from incredible suffering condition, Krishna will just come and lift up that person. We also got today is fasting for Lord Varaha and Lord Nityananda, but tomorrow are their appearance day. In the same way, again, Lord Varaha, that pastime, we meet Lord Varaha two times in Srimad Bhagavatam. In this white Lord Varaha, who comes when the earth, Bhumandala, is sinking down into the ocean, in the Garbhadak ocean, in the bottom of the universe. And Lord Varaha comes, he dives into the ocean and lifts up earth. And then again we see him in his red form. The red form of Varaha comes when, in the pastime of when the two gatekeepers, Jai and Vijay, fall from the spiritual world. Jai appears as the great demon Hiranyaksha. So Hiranyaksha comes and he tries to drag down the earth into the ocean. Again, Lord Varaha appears and dives down into the ocean and lifts up earth, Mother Earth, to preserve it. And so you find in India there's two temples where you can, in one temple in Rajasthan, where there is a depiction of this, of earth as Bhumandala, the flat earth. That's one for all the flat earth boffins, that it's a flat plane, and Lord Varaha is lifting up. There's another beautiful deity in South India somewhere, a very large deity of Lord Varaha, and he's on his lap is Bhumi Devi, Mother Earth. So he's rescued his devotee, he's rescuing Mother Earth from sinking, from drowning in the material ocean. And of course, Lord Nityananda, he's Balaram himself. And Balaram is Shesha, Ananta Shesha, who's carrying Krishna in the form of Lord Vishnu in each material universe. Lord Vishnu is reclining on Ananta Shesha. So this Balaram is the first expansion of Krishna, who provides all the support for Krishna, all the support for the pastimes and all the paraphernalia. And in the same way, Lord Nityananda appears in secret incarnation as Lord Nityananda to take the pastimes with Lord Gauranga. And we'll be celebrating that tomorrow, the appearance of Lord Nityananda. So Lord Nityananda also, if we approach Lord Nityananda, then we will be able to, he will give us the blessings to approach Lord Chaitanya, to approach Krishna in the proper way. So Krishna is always appearing to support his devotees in one way or another. And so we see with Mother Yashoda, when she's directly there with Krishna and she's trying so hard to bind Krishna with the ropes, and it's just not happening. And almost at the point when she's giving up, Krishna sees that her determination, he sees her love and her determination to bind him. So then he allows himself to be bound by ropes. And finally she is able to bind him with these ropes. The shortage of two fingers is about that. It's about two things. It's about the effort of the devotee to approach Krishna with love and to have that steady faith completely in Krishna. And with that steady faith, then we can have surrender to the whole process and we can advance. And the second one is the mercy of the Lord himself. When he sees that effort put in by the devotee, then he reciprocates and he will uplift that devotee, allow. So Mother Yashoda was able to bind Krishna. So that's what this pastime is really all about. And it should give us, as devotees, a lot of faith that we should just remain determined and increase our surrender in full faith that Krishna will always be there, no matter what circumstance. According to our ability, we can surrender. Obviously, some can surrender a lot more than others, but all of us can surrender at least a little bit, always in chanting and reading the pastimes and reading together the pastimes. It's a very powerful process by which we can do this. And as for the conditioned souls, we can just pray that as devotees, we can find more avenues into the world society to try and instruct them about the values of devotional service and the values of chanting Hare Krishna. So I'll leave it at that, Hare Krishna. So if anyone's got any questions, I can try and answer them, or comments, please.